Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's joining us here for Happy Hour with Dr. T. Each week, we get together two nights a week. On Tuesday night is guest night, where we have amazing conversations about biblical end times and books and current events. And on Thursday nights, in the month of August, it was Dr. T solo. Now we're starting another four-part series special event that we are doing with just some amazing, we've done a whole series of these. And if you're a premium podcast member, you have a lifetime access to them. If you are not a premium podcast member and you'd like to be, go to drtenpenny.com, hover over the podcast tab, and you will see that there are, we've created something for everyone's time and budget. With that, tonight we're going to kick off another important series for Happy Hour with Dr. T special events. As you know, over the last several years, we've hosted special series events on deeper Bible study on Thursday nights. We've completed several series with pastors Doug Van Dorn, Mike Spaulding, and authors Doug Woodward, Derek Gilbert, and L.A. Marzulli, which are now available at learningforyou.org, my sister educational site. 100% of those sales proceeds go back to the authors of these amazing four-part courses as a thank you for their time and for their effort. And as a premium podcast member, like I already said, you have lifetime access to these courses. So go over there and join up and become a member. They have lots of other benefits too. The feedback we've had on these have been great, and we're continuing this special series of events through 2024. Tonight is part one of an important four-part series that is a very deep exploration of the Book of Enoch with author and researcher Dr. Judd Burton. We're going to take a really quick break. We will be right back. You will not want to miss this. I've been looking forward to this for 2 months. We'll be right back. Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant. You can take it when you're nursing. You can give it to little children. You can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out, the heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch with in our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years. Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off. Well, welcome back, everyone. Dr. Judd Burton is a historian and anthropologist. He has a master's degree in anthropology and a PhD in history. Over the last 25 years, he has taught college-level anthropology, history, humanities, and religion. He has conducted research and expeditions around the world. Dr. Burton is the director and senior fellow of the Institute of Biblical Anthropology and author of several books, including The Interview of the Giant and The Interview with the Giant of Peneus. In this series, The Book of Enoch, History, Culture, and Prophecy, we will cover the history, content, and supernatural import of Enoch Book 1, 2, and 3, a compilation of apocryphal works centered around the antediluvian patriarch Enoch. Included in the discussion will be the history of the community that produced Enoch, the Essenes, the cultural background, a brief summary of scholarship, the description of the Watchers and the Nephilim, the account of the origin of demons and monsters that proliferated in the world lore, biblical reference, and prophetic implications. Now, can you imagine we're going to get all that in 4 weeks? I mean, I think that is just amazing. So this four-week series will help you understand the Book of Enoch, which is an enigma to a lot of people. A lot of people think it's not biblical. We shouldn't even be talking about it. But until you understand it and explore it, you won't know where to apply it in your life. So here in week one, we're going to look at the historical background of the Book of Enoch and Dr. Burton's personal intersect with the book and we're going to discuss the contents of Enoch 1, accounts of the fallen angels, the Nephilim, demons and chimeras, the flood, the judgment of reprobates, and the broader cosmological issues. Woo! How about that? Dr. Judd, welcome to Happy Hour with Dr. T Intensive. This sounds fantastic, and it is a lot to cover, so I'm going to let you just take it and run with it.
Thank you, Dr. Timpenny. I'm glad to be here. The Book of Enoch has made quite the buzz over the last couple of decades, particularly. But of course, it's for biblical scholars, it's been of interest for quite some time. But I would say the last quarter century, in particular, you've seen an uptake in the interest in the Book of Enoch. Owing to an increase in what one might call marginal or peripheral topics within biblical scholarship. But at the end of the day, they're not very marginal at all. They're just sort of strange and unusual and not fleshed out very well in a lot of theology. I should probably begin this talk about the Book of Enoch with just a brief description of the book itself. It's a collection of apocryphal literature that doesn't belong to most canons of the Bible. There are some, like the Ethiopic Bible, that include Enoch, but as you pointed out in the introduction, there's a great deal of coverage about the antediluvian world, particularly as regarding the biblical patriarch Enoch's experience in that pre-flood world. So that's the nature of the Book of Enoch that we'll be looking at during the series. But in addition to that brief summary, I should probably tell a little story about how I even got interested in topics like giants and fallen angels and the Book of Enoch. I was an undergraduate at Hardin-Simmons University. Was just about to complete a bachelor's degree in history with a lot of focus on theology and religion. And I had at the encouragement and behest of one of my mentors, the late Dr. George Knight, had signed up for an expedition to Israel. A couple of the professors took a group of students to Israel every summer to excavate at a site. The site that they had been working at in previous years was none other than biblical Caesarea Philippi. And Caesarea Philippi is, for Bible readers, they'll be familiar with that name. In Matthew chapter 16 and Mark chapter 8, we get an account of Jesus visiting Caesarea Philippi and making these statements about his messiahship and the foundation of the church. And arguably, the transfiguration takes place on nearby Mount Hermon. Caesarea Philippi is on the southwestern spur of Mount Hermon in Upper Galilee in Israel. And that location, for people who are familiar with Enoch, will be familiar in terms of its importance. But I'll talk a little bit more about that as Mount Hermon deals directly with a series of events that occur in the Book of Enoch. I say all that just to say that in the weeks and months leading up to our departure, I read everything that I could get my hands on the site itself, which has been variously known by different names throughout its history. Panaeus, because the Greeks thought that Pan, the god, the shepherd god Pan, lived there, is one of the lasting names, Panaeus, or the Panaeon. When Herod the Great's son, Philip, became tetrarch of the region, it became known as Caesarea Philippi. But it has a long history of association with the worship of these nature deities like Pan, going all the way back to the Baals, and a host of goat demons and goat gods that were worshipped by people in the area. And so in the weeks leading up to our departure, I read everything that I could find in the library there on campus, including a master's thesis on the Petrine Confession that took place at Caesarea Philippi. And so I got a pretty good summative history of the site. But because I read this student's thesis, he made reference to this apocryphal literature that I was not largely familiar with, that included documents from the cache of documents found near Qumran in 1947 that are collectively known as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And these were works like the Book of Enoch, works such as the related works like the Genesis Apocryphon and the Book of Giants, the Book of Jubilees. All of these deal with a lot of the same kind of material. And so I familiarized myself with it. And in the course of reading the Book of Enoch, one learns very quickly that the Genesis 6 material that talks about the fallen sons of God, the fallen angels cohabiting with women and producing the Nephilim, the first race of giants, that is explicated and expounded in the Book of Enoch, particularly in the first section of the Book of Enoch, which is known as the Book of the Watchers. But there is this colorful, detailed commentary that exists within the Book of Enoch on those events, going so far as to name the angels that were essentially the leaders of this coup, and the very, we get a culture shot, a culture sketch of what they introduced, what they taught to humanity, and what the first races of giants were like. And it occurred to me that, goodness, we're going to be excavating right at the foot of this mountain. And I can remember arriving in Israel, and specifically at the site of Caesarea Philippi, seeing it for the first time, and then the weeks that ensued of working in the shadow of Mount Hermon with all of this on my mind. For a young, impressionable scholar to be, it was quite the experience. When I signed up for the expedition, I was largely interested in just learning the rudiments of field archaeology. but the scientific endeavors of this particular expedition quickly turned into a kind of pilgrimage for me. And it led me down this path of studying these topics, like the giants, like the fallen angels, what all that has in a bearing towards Christian theology, towards a sound biblical theology. And so I relate that story because it's an essential part of the long chain of events that led me to study these topics and write on them and speak on them and teach on them. So let's back up a little bit and talk a little bit more about the Book of Enoch itself. Excuse me. Enoch is, as I said, an apocryphal text. And there are actually three books that bear the name of Enoch. Most of what we'll be concerned in this series is what's commonly referred to as First Enoch or One Enoch. This is the Book of Enoch that most people are referencing whenever they mention the text. There are two other works, Second and Third Enoch, which will be peripheral largely to our discussion, but still important. that are written much later, in fact, centuries later than the Book of Enoch, and deal with a lot of the same kind of material. But First Enoch is a compilation of documents that are written largely in Hebrew and Aramaic. We do have some fragments that are written in Greek. Most of the Book of Enoch dates to the early 4th century to the late 2nd century BC. And it was written during what biblical scholars call the Second Temple period, this period from about 400 BC after the return of the Jews from Babylon, the rebuilding of the temple. That's why it's called the Second Temple period, and going all the way into the first century AD. It's in a lot of ways, this period, the historical period, is the connective tissue between ancient Judaism and Christianity, particularly because of the document that we're talking about today and the general cache of documents and the community that produced it. It's really kind of an interesting time for biblical history. Growing up in the Southern Baptist Church, you didn't really hear a lot about the Second Temple period or the interbiblical period. I remember one Sunday school teacher describing it as a lull or a silence between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And of course, we know that that's not the case at all. There's quite a bit going on that's relative to the Bible and its growth and compilation, not the least of which are the writings of these apocryphal works, but also the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, is also produced during this time in Alexandria. It's a time of transition in a lot of ways politically for Israel, because there is a procession of conquering nations that dominate the country. They only have autonomy for very brief interregnums throughout this, so that they're dealing with people, particularly the Greeks in the wake of Alexander the Great. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids both had control at one time in Israel. And then, of course, the Romans arrive in the first century BC. There are also some interesting things taking place in terms of period Judaism itself. It's not a monolithic religion. And I'm talking about all this stuff because it's a necessary background, necessary backdrop in order to flesh out the import and the meaning and the purpose of something like the Book of Enoch. But there are multiple factions within Judaism that develop in this period. The two main ones that most people know about, of course, are the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Sadducees being involved in the temple infrastructure, and the Pharisees being the legalistic scribes of the law and teachers of the law, the people that strain the gnats, in other words, that we hear about a lot of times. Well, one of the splinter groups that breaks off from the temple infrastructure, temple Judaism, is a group called the Essenes, and they had basically deemed that there was too much corruption within the hierarchy there in Jerusalem, and so they left and developed these monastic communities along the Dead Sea and in other places. The Essenes actually ended up in northern Israel as well, but the most populous centers of their conclaves were on the Dead Sea. Notably, the Qumran community. And the Essenes had some different ideas about how to worship Yahweh. They were very monastic in their approach to this, living very simple lives, taking part in ritual bathing, a kind of baptism, if you will. And a lot of what they begin to write about is apocalyptic and messianic in its bent. And we'll delve more into that as the series goes along. But it's an interesting set of circumstances that unfurl, that form the venue, the cultural venue in which the Book of Enoch itself is written. And thanks to a host of scholars, people like George Nicholsberg, who I'll bring up, has done a really good job of illustrating this connective tissue between Judaism and Christianity that people, once they begin to delve into a study of the Essenes, begin to find it. And just to tantalize people a little bit, there are all kinds of references to the Messiah in the Book of Enoch. Titles like the Son of Man that we would be familiar with from the New Testament, in terms of the description of Jesus, also show up in the Book of Enoch. And so it's valuable on a number of levels, not just because of its explication of the pre-flood world and of Enoch and the fallen angels and the giants and everything that's strange and bizarre that's going on there. But it's important in terms of how Jewish people are thinking apocalyptically in that time, because certainly there were people that were familiar with Essenic thought outside of their communities in Israel. So that sort of sets the pace for a discussion of the Book of Enoch and its contents.
And you know, that's a really good place to stop right there and have a quick break before you go into the next part. We've got the historical backdrop, and then we're going to get into more of what Book One is all about. Today, we're having a great introductory discussion to our four-part series with Dr. Judd Burton, historian and anthropologist. We're talking about the Book of Enoch, and we're just getting started. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. There are an awful lot of people that are affiliates for Mike Lindell because we all really appreciate what he does for this country. We appreciate the hard work that he does, and we appreciate his products. He has more than 200 products in his store, everything from pillowcases and comforters to doggy beds and to wonderful slippers and bathrobes. There's something for everybody and something for everybody in each age group. I mean, one of the things that I really like a lot are the pillowcases, the children's Bible story pillowcases that I just think are such a great way when you tuck your child into bed at night to use these pillowcases that they come from his store to start to tell the story about Adam and Eve and Noah and the Ark and different things. And they're colorful and they're really pretty. So from children all the way up to your gentlemen that want to have like nice slippers, or to your dog, the doggy beds and things are just wonderful. So my pillow is a great place to shop for just about anything that you want. And if you use our affiliate code DRT, that helps us, that can benefit us, that helps Mike Lindell, and you'll get a great product for anybody that you're shopping for. Well, welcome back, everyone. We're going to continue on with this discussion this morning that we're doing with the Book of Enoch and Dr. Burton's experience that he told us about how he got interested in it. And now we're going to move into more about the contents of Enoch Book One, the fallen angels, Nephilim, demons, chimera, all that sort of thing. So sit tight. This is the second part of part one. Welcome back, Dr. Judd. Go ahead and take it off from there.
Good to be back. Derek Gilbert asked me one time, why should people be interested in giants and fallen angels and the Book of Enoch, that sort of thing. And I told him, I said, two words, Caesarea Philippi, because Jesus was interested in it, because his disciples were interested in it, because it formed a fundamental part of their theology and our theology by proxy. And so much of what transpires in the Book of Enoch, Jesus's disciples and of course Jesus himself would have been familiar with. Much of the Jewish population of Israel would have been familiar with the traditions about Enoch, the traditions of the fallen angels that were associated with Mount Hermon and the Peneus region. And so that really brings us to the threshold of the first part of the Book of Enoch, which is arguably the part of the Book of Enoch that most people are drawn to just because of the nature of its content. And like a lot of scripture, you find that although we're talking about non-canon works here, although it deals with these very kinds of arcane topics like the fallen angels and giants and the occult and magic and the corruption of humanity. You have adulations to Yahweh in it. You have praises to Yahweh. You have the acknowledgement of Yahweh. There are poetic elements in parts of it. So it behaves like you would expect a lot of ancient Jewish writing to behave. The Book of Enoch, the Book of the Watchers, lays out the Genesis 6 event. And for people who aren't familiar with when I reference Genesis 6, Genesis 6 is the passage of the Old Testament that introduces this concept, albeit very briefly, but it talks about the sons of God, the Benach Elohim, the angels. And we know that they're talking about angels because this phrase is analogously used in other passages in the Bible. But these were angels that came to the earth and took wives, cohabited with human women, and produced the Nephilim, the first race of giants in the Bible. And this is all part of the story of the corruption of humanity. And the absolute moral depravity that results because of this interference and the subsequent deluge, the flood, the Noahic flood. And Enoch, particularly the Book of Watchers, but in general, the Book of First Enoch, gives us an expanded look into this world. Enoch is referenced in the Bible. He's one of the Antediluvian patriarchs, but his story is very short. Enoch was only on the earth for a few centuries. As the Bible says, he walked with God and was no more. He was didn't die. He was literally taken up into heaven. He's the father of Methuselah and the great grandfather of Noah. So Enoch, in a lot of ways, is some of the best commentary that we have on Genesis chapter 6, and other references to Benach Elohim and fallen deities and entities like the Nephilim, like the Rephaim, like the Anakim. The question quickly emerges once you begin to delve into not just the material, but also delving into the history of the work is, was this, because it bears the name of Enoch, was it actually written by this antediluvian patriarch? Well, the authorship is up in the air. That's why scholars include Enoch in a collection of non-canon works that they call pseudepigrapha. That doesn't mean that the works are false or bad somehow. It simply means that the authorship may not be the name that's given to the book. So in the case of Enoch, we don't know for sure. I have a supposition, surmise that Enoch existed in oral form long before it was ever written down. And we know that there's a biblical precedent for this because the law, the Torah, existed orally long before it was ever written down by Moses. So the fact that this oral tradition crystallizes in the form of the Book of Enoch shouldn't come as a surprise, because there's precedent not only in ancient Hebrew culture, but also in other cultures. And from an anthropological perspective, questions might arise about the reliability of the account. Because a lot of scholars tend to question the validity, the dependability of oral history, oral traditions. But there's really not a need for that in a lot of cases. We already have precedent for complex amounts of information being transferred accurately through oral tradition. By way of analogy, the Anasazi were able to transmit astronomical data to generations. For instance, they might predict a celestial event that might not occur for five generations, but they transmit that information with such accuracy orally that generation knew exactly when and where to look when their time came around. Another example of analogy would be the Druids of ancient Britain. They memorized thousands upon thousands of sets of these three-line axioms. And even in ancient Jewish culture, ancient Hebrew culture, the scribal institution was such that there was redundancy. And I suspect that this also goes back to when Hebrews were largely an oral culture.
You know, I had a question about that, because
certainly
I've read in various places, you know, there's always been this dispute between why the Book of Enoch was included as a canon text, as they refer it, you know, included mm-hmm. in the Bible, and then mm-hmm. not. And the biggest argument that I've heard is because we don't know exactly who authored it, which mm-hmm. you just sort of addressed. But what I found kind of interesting, I just finished a reading of mine that I just read through the minor prophets in the Bible, mm-hmm. which I'd never done before. I'd never, you know, I'd read Jonah and I'd read little, you know, lines here and there, but I've read, you know, the entire set of the minor prophets. And, you know, the prophet Joel, they don't know who he is or what he was, or they don't even know where mm-hmm. he was from. So I'm reading that and it made me think about the Book of Enoch. It's like, so mm-hmm. why was that included, but the Book of Enoch was excluded?
Well, the canon issue is an interesting question in and of itself. The fact of the matter is that many of the early church fathers, that is the first leaders of the Christian churches in the first few centuries, really the first three centuries of Christianity, you know, people like Justin Martyr and Irenaeus and Tertullian and Origen, there's a whole laundry list of them. But a lot of these guys did consider Enoch to be canon. They did consider Enoch to be the author. At the very least, even those that didn't consider it to be canon, they recognized it as biblically relevant and theologically congruent to the accepted canon. Most of the a lot of people like to think about Enoch as just sort of, you know, the bishops at the Council of Nicaea in 325 being called together, you know, reading through it and throwing it over their shoulders. You know, I said, oh, we don't need this, you know, anymore. We don't even really know if this is Enoch. But the fact of the matter is that most of the canon that we recognize was in place before the Council of Nicaea convened in 325. Irenaeus, who was a part of a lineage of students that went back to John the Apostle, he had studied in Ephesus and eventually became the Bishop of Lyon in France. But Irenaeus had circulated a letter through the churches about the not just the epistles, but the gospels, where authorship was in the greatest certitude. And of course, the Old Testament that these folks were using was the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures. And so much of the canon was already in place. And it's actually 6 years after the Council of Nicaea, where Constantine convenes a committee of bishops to print up 50 copies of the Bible. So a lot of the legwork was already done. It wasn't a matter of just peripheralizing something like Enoch. Probably you don't really start to see that until people like Julius Africanus and Augustine of Hippo, St. Augustine, that a lot of people will be familiar with, this bishop from North Africa in the late 4th and early 5th centuries. That's really when the ideas contained in these apocryphal books like Enoch and the Genesis Apocryphon and Jubilees about fallen angels cohabiting with women sort of get peripheralized. And in the case of Augustine, that probably stems from, in my estimation, stems from his involvement in a group called the Manichaeans, who, interestingly enough, were a Gnostic sect. And they used one of these apocryphal texts as their scripture, one of which was the Book of Giants, which includes a lot of the same kind of material that Enoch does. And my suspicion as a historian is that Enoch, or rather Augustine, because of his experiences with this group, the Manichaeans, and their embracement of these ideas about fallen angels cohabiting with human females and producing giants, thought that this was peripheral and not theologically relevant and maybe even heretical. It's kind of interesting because Augustine gives us he certainly believed in demons because he drums them in his work, The City of God. But without getting too far off topic, that point is illustrative of the canon issues with Enoch. Enoch just really sort of falls out of favor along with some of these other apocryphal works through most of the Christian world after the 4th and 5th centuries AD, with exceptions like the Ethiopic Church and Ethiopic Judaism. Both of those groups embraced Enoch as scripture. And in fact, when the Book of Enoch was first discovered, rediscovered rather, it was not in the Hebrew and Aramaic forms, but it was in the liturgical language of the Ethiopic Church, Ge'ez. And those copies began to filter back into Europe. But there are That was the decisive factor of considering canon, moving towards the Council of Nicaea and the meeting of those bishops that Constantine convened in the years afterwards, was the certitude of authorship. That was one of the driving, if not the main driving factor. And as I pointed out, most of that legwork had already been done by people like Irenaeus in the circulation of his letter about the New Testament. But the you certainly can't prove beyond the shadow of doubt. But I think that there's a lot to be said about these oral traditions that are archaic, prehistoric, probably.
So what you're basically saying is that it was excluded because people couldn't tell if it was real or not real because of the oral tradition. And so that's the reason it was not included in the Bible, even though a lot of people have said that it should be, because it, as you'll get into this discussion more, all the different things that are part of Enoch that, you know, I've had people say to me before, things like, you know, they make some quotes out of one Enoch and say, man, don't you think that would be kind of important to know, you know, about the historical sort of context. So, you know, in terms of the fallen angels and the Nephilim and things like that, but it was kind of excluded because of the oral traditions. And it makes a lot of sense because there are a lot of cultures with oral traditions. I mean, American Indians, the Indians, you know, of South America, you know, that's the way that they transmitted their history was, you know, the elders would talk to the younger people and they would have to memorize what their history was all about. So that seems like kind of a lame excuse.
Well, a lot. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you 100%. But the standards of scholarship in the Greco-Roman world, which impacted the early church fathers, a lot of these guys had studied at these academies, and were trained in the Greek way, as Edith Hamilton would call it. But the dotting every I and crossing every T in terms of establishing authorship became one of the decisive factors, even really long before Nicaea. And I don't think that's incidental. You know, God's hand was in this process throughout the entirety of it. But it doesn't mean that these other works aren't important, even if they're pseudepigrapha, even if they're based on oral tradition that's collated, you know, over the centuries and finally distilled once a writing system is available. I think that because they're referenced in places in the New Testament, like Jude and 2 Peter, and because in some cases they didn't have to be referenced directly in either the New Testament or the Old Testament, because people understood. We have to understand the ancient audience. There's a lot that would have been implicit that an author didn't necessarily have to write and articulate in order for the audience to understand that, because they would have already understood I began this discussion with Caesarea Philippi and Mount Hermon. You know, Jesus's disciples would have known without him saying much, if anything, about these apocryphal traditions and this apocryphal literature. They would have known about Enoch. They would have known about its account of Mount Hermon and the fallen angels. And because they were intersecting with demons on a regular basis, they knew about it because they had their worldview regarding those kinds of things was directed by the Second Temple period ideology, particularly, I would argue, from the Essenes, the sepulchral literature coming out of their community.
And you know, I've heard that said too, also about the, you know, like the books of Moses, the five books of Moses, that there were a lot of things that he didn't go into a lot of detail about. I mean, sure. Things like the flood and, you know, the Nephilim, that they were here before and after. And he didn't go into a lot of detail, because when he was writing it, like you said, that the oral traditions, that the people that, you know, all around him would say, like, well, why are you spending so much time on that? Everybody knows that. Not thinking that 2,000, 4,000, 6,000 years, we may not know anything about it. And we're sort of making, kind of pulling on non-biblical text to sort of fill in the gap. You know, as we're kind of winding down in our first session here today, Dr. Judd, what would you like to say in sort of summarizing what where we've come from and where we're going to go next?
Well, much of our discussion today in this session has been setting the stage, so to speak, the history, the culture, the community that produced it. But we're really about to delve into what I think is probably for our time amongst the most pertinent material in the Book of Enoch, talking about the antediluvian world, about the fallen angels, about the origin of demons, the nature of demons. We've largely, because of this apocryphal literature, we're developing this taxonomy of the demonic realm that we hadn't in previous decades. So much of what we'll talk about in our next session will center around that, because I think that that's amongst the most important material in Enoch. But we'll also talk about, you know, what potential relevances, you know, does this have to the ministry of Jesus? And in other sessions, we'll talk about, you know, what happened to the Essenes, the people that actually produced this literature. What bearing did it have on the ministry of Jesus? What are the prophetic considerations in something like the Book of Enoch? And of course, those other pseudepigrapha that bear the name of Enoch, 2nd and 3rd Enoch. We'll touch on those as well.
Wow. Well, but this has been... go ahead. I'm sorry. I mean to interrupt.
I would just say the wonderful thing about this book is that it's so easily accessible. You don't have to be able to read Hebrew or Aramaic in order to read it. They're public domain databases that people can access. And as I talk about some of the scholarship and sources, I'll point people to some of these places that they can go to where you can actually read the Book of Enoch for yourself.
Very good. Well, I know that this is a lively topic that's come up a lot and has some controversy. Like you said, you know, like, why are you bothering reading that? I remember this was not too terribly long ago. I had asked a friend of mine, a fairly staunch Christian friend of mine. I said, you know, I'm thinking about buying an Ethiopian Bible and reading just what the difference is. She said, that's heresy. Why would you even have that in your house? You know, and it's like that sort of a divisiveness about, I only study the Bible and this is the only thing. And I just don't believe that way, because I think that a lot of the non-biblical texts just add a richness and flavor of historical backdrops. And that if you have more of a background in the history, it brings the Bible more alive, because you understand what the people were reading and what the times were like about that. So I'm so excited about moving forward into part two and part three of this, and part four of this series that we're doing on the Book of Enoch. So I want to thank everybody who's joined us here today, and know that part one was just like the warm-up session of giving us the background information that we have to know in order to be able to move forward and understand what's coming next. So Dr. Judd, I thank you so much for being here. And I want to thank everybody else for being here with us today. You know, before we close out, is there a place, you know, I know you have a lot of other courses and things that you offer. Where are some of those courses that people can go and dig deeper into these type of topics?
Certainly. People can go to burtonbeyond.net, and that's where the Institute of Biblical Anthropology page is at. And if you'll follow the menu, people can go and check out the programs that I offer. I have biblical anthropology, biblical demonology, preternatural morphology, which is the hottest class right now. It's my buddy Derek Gilbert calls it Monsters 101, but it's looking at that sort of thing through the biblical lens. And I have some more standard classes like mythology, ancient Near Eastern civilization, and Mediterranean civilization. And if people go through the coursework, they can get the certification that accompanies that.
And say the website again, please.
BurtonBeyond.net.
Okay, that is that's really amazing, and there's lots and lots of information there. And so what we're talking about here with the Book of Enoch, we're just sort of scraping the surface. So with that, I want to just close out with one of my favorite verses from the Bible. I close all my podcasts with, whether they are live or pre-recorded, which is, rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So we'll be here again next week, same place, same time, with part two of this study into understanding what Enoch 1 is all about. And we'll touch a little bit on Enoch 2 and 3. And so we'll see you again here next week. Good night and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body's vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com, and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.